You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to the unanswered legal question mentioned in the story you just heard, which has halted the resentencing process for a majority of Michigan's so-called juvenile lifers. Here's the question. It's whether judges or juries should be the ones to determine whether life without parole is a suitable sentence under the Supreme Court's standards. Now, the court has said life without parole for juveniles should be rare. But in Michigan, according to the State Appellate Defender Office, which is handling a large number of these cases, prosecutors are seeking life without parole again for over 60%. That's more than 200 juvenile offenders. And not much is happening with these cases until this question is resolved. Yesterday, we asked Genesee County Prosecutor David Layton about the judge versus jury question, and here's what he said.
I think you have to retry the case if you're going to get a jury of laypeople to understand why it is we're here today asking for juvenile life without parole. You can't do it just based upon new evidence. You have to be able to show everything that transpired, and it would require a retrial of that case.
Here with us now is Kimberly Thomas. She's a clinical professor of law at the University of Michigan and the co-founder of the school's Juvenile Justice Clinic, which is representing Tia Skinner, one of the people convicted in the case you just heard about in Shana Roth's story. Thomas argues it should be a jury to decide whether a juvenile should receive life without parole. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You argued before the Michigan Court of Appeals that a jury should decide that life without parole punishment for a juvenile offender, and the appeals panel agreed. What did you argue? Why should a jury decide?
Well, a jury should decide because the Sixth Amendment says if there are facts that increase someone's punishment from what just the verdict in their case, that those facts should be found by a jury. And the comparison that I think is really helpful for us to think about here is the death penalty context. And so the U.S. Supreme Court has said over and over again that those facts that are being found that subject someone to the death penalty have to be found by a jury, and that the Constitution requires that.
So you argued this, and the appeals court panel agreed with you, but then something happened. Some other judges on the appeals court disagreed with their colleagues' ruling. So they convened something called a conflict panel. Tell us what happened and what a conflict panel is.
The conflict panel is when there is a decision of the Court of Appeals that goes one way and another panel that says, well, if we weren't bound by that prior decision, we would go another way. And they ask the court to resolve that conflict between the groups of individual Court of Appeals judges.
And how rare is a conflict panel in your experience? Have you seen one before?
I don't see them that often in criminal cases, which is my area. No, I don't.
And as we heard the Genesee County prosecutor in this earlier clip, he argues that you'd have to retry the whole case if you want a jury to consider the sentence. And I'm assuming that you disagree. Why doesn't the case have to be completely retried, in your view, for a jury to be able to decide the sentence?
So as I said, that the death penalty can give us some guidance on this. So even if a case comes just for a sentencing hearing, and the case has already been tried years and years ago, and sometimes that happens, those facts that are going to be found to make someone eligible for the death penalty in other states still have to be found by a jury unless the person waives their right to a jury. And so those same kinds of procedures could be implemented in these cases.
Is it basically doing a whole retrial, as he argued?
No. I mean, each party could decide to agree to what information could be heard. The conviction in these cases isn't at issue. All of these people stand duly convicted of homicide. The question is only what the sentence should be.
So he feels you'd be pulling out the records and digging up things from maybe decades ago, but you're saying that that's not necessarily the case.
So what the court has told us in Miller and Montgomery is that the question for sentencing focuses on the individual, not on the crime. The crime has occurred. Everyone agrees the crime happened and the person is guilty of that crime. The question is what that shows about this offender. Does the crime show that this person is irreparably corrupt? Has this person shown that they've made efforts to rehabilitate themselves? What does that look like?
So in Michigan, it has always been the judges who determine sentences like this. Let's listen now from Kalamazoo prosecutor Jeffrey Getting.
normally when we think about the criminal justice system and the person who has the authority to make that decision regarding the consequence to be imposed, we're talking about the court. And we're talking about making a decision after being provided with all of the information from both sides, advocating, as I do, for the people of the state of Michigan and for the victims of the crime, and on the other side, advocating for the defendant, the person who was convicted of murder.
So he's saying there that both sides, the prosecution and the defense, should present their arguments before a judge as to whether a life without parole sentence is warranted. How does this rise to a finding of fact and therefore should be considered by a jury and not a judge?
So what really I believe the Sixth Amendment requires is that initial finding of fact that would subject someone to a life without parole sentence. And the court has said, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that we need can only give a life without parole sentence to someone who's only eligible for life without parole if they've been shown to be irreparably corrupt. And so once a jury determines someone is irreparably corrupt, I don't disagree with Mr. Getting that a judge could make a determination of the appropriate sentence within that range. It's just that the jury has to find that fact that allows the sentence of life without parole.
That term, irreparably corrupt, is there a hard and fast guideline that lets you know when you've crossed that boundary, or is it something that's rather fluid?
There's no hard and fast guidance from the U.S. Supreme Court at this point what that means. The court has told us that that's the line, what that we need to focus on, and I'm sure that there'll be a lot of discussion in the years to come about what that means, how you determine the rare case that should be eligible for, or could be eligible for life without parole from the common case that should not be.
That's going to be batted around a lot, I can tell. Is that something ultimately that you could see the court deciding?
Yes, and our Court of Appeals began to address that question. In the conflict panel case in Hyatt, the court said that on appellate review, the court should look as inherently suspect a sentence of life without parole, trying to implement what the Montgomery court held in terms of, you know, really it being the rare case.
And I wondered how much of a challenge do you think that these prosecutors in Michigan are going to be faced in changing the way they're used to doing things? It seems like almost a change in culture and the way they view their role in the criminal justice system.
I think that Montgomery and Miller will force that change and have required that change.
What change? Just how do you see this change?
How I see the change is we've gone from what used to be the status quo in Michigan where life without parole for a young person was not considered to be unusual, was not considered to be something that we would have to think carefully about or examine the details of that person's life. In fact, it wasn't even permitted by statute, to a situation where the U.S. Supreme Court has told us that as a matter of constitutional law, we have to do that and we have to only impose life without parole in the rare circumstances. And so that is a change.
If you just joined us, we're speaking with Kimberly Thomas, who's a clinical professor of law at the University of Michigan, and she's the co-founder of the school's Juvenile Justice Clinic. The prosecutors with whom we've spoken, to a T, all say their priority lies with the victims and their families. And yes, they have discretion to decide the charges, but if the families want to reimpose a life without parole sentence, most said they would go with what the family wants. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think that there are a few things. The prosecutor has an independent duty as a matter of their position to represent the people. And so I think, you know, that obviously they're going to listen to the victims' families, and that's an important part of their role. It's also important for them to have a system-wide or county-wide view of the situation. And so in a lot of studies, for example, the death penalty, there's been some disparity by victim and victim's family in terms of who received the death penalty. And so you wouldn't want, I think we would all disagree with just having a victim who's particularly vehement or particularly articulate, and that person getting life without parole and it not being based upon also the offense of conviction, the circumstances of the offense, the offender, and whether he or she has shown rehabilitation. So it's really much more than just, and that's an important factor, but there's more that needs to be considered too.
Why do we leave it to prosecutors in Michigan to make these decisions? Could we be taking other approaches?
So the U.S. Supreme Court had said that in Montgomery that certainly a constitutional approach would be to translate all of the sentences to parolable life sentence and shift that authority for release to the Michigan Parole Board. The Parole Board would then, under that kind of system, have the ability to release or not release based on whether they believe that the person has shown to be rehabilitated would be safe to be released to the community.
But we're not doing that now.
No, that's not the system that our legislature set up. But the Supreme Court has said that would be an alternative for states to adopt.
And have other states adopted that?
Some states have gone that way. States have really done a variety of different things. A number of states have just chosen to eliminate life without parole entirely because they think that that's a way to solve the constitutional problem, to save the state the money of redoing all of these cases over again. And, you know, so that's obviously another approach that's been taken.
What do you see next in terms of when the Michigan Supreme Court will take up this judge or jury question? When are you expecting a ruling?
I don't know. I can't read those tea leaves. But, you know, the question is presented to them if they want to hear it. They might decide to see what happens with other cases before they hear it. That's really in their prerogative.
Well, in the meantime, what's happening with all the people who were sentenced to life without parole and have not been considered for a new sentence? Where are they?
For cases where prosecutors are seeking life without parole, those cases are largely on hold right now, to see whether or not the Michigan Supreme Court is interested in deciding the question of judge versus jury.
And if they're not, then what?
Then I think that prosecutors will have to make decisions about whether to go forward. Obviously, no one wants to do these hearings more than once. You want to do them in a way that is final and will, you know, resolve it for once and for all.
Michigan has gotten national attention as an outlier in this. What are your thoughts on where Michigan stands compared to other states?
So Michigan had a very large number of juveniles serving life without parole at the time of the Miller verdict. And so I think just the sheer numbers has drawn attention to Michigan to wonder why Michigan is different in that way. And then I think some of the other states with a large population of juvenile life without parole have taken a slightly different approach. For example, Pennsylvania had even more, but about 300 of those are out of Philadelphia County, where the city of Philadelphia is. And the prosecutor there has indicated that he's going to not seek life without parole on almost all of those cases. And so there's a different approach that's been taken there.
And why? Why? I guess I'm wondering why so different in so many Michigan counties than what you just described in Philadelphia?
I'm not sure, really. As I mentioned, there's that history of prosecutors having choice on this. I think it'll take a while for Miller-Montgomery to sink in. But beyond that, I'm not really sure.
Kim Thomas, University of Michigan law professor, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.